Oh, I am really sorry if you had some Friday afternoon or evening plans, because you are not going to get to them. Because we got 2 good hours of radio that you're not going to want to miss. The second hour is the game show and a super top secret celebrity guest when we get to the game show second hour. Arlo K. Usardbre, if you can speak Pig Latin, then you know who it is. This hour, some screen time with Deacon Stephen Graydonis. We're going to talk about film from a Catholic perspective, and this is always a treat. And so Stephen Graydonis is a deacon indeed, the creator of decentfilms.com and the film critic for the National Catholic Register. He is a member of the New York Film Critics Circle and a permanent deacon in the Archdiocese of Newark, New Jersey. With David DeCerto, he co-hosts the Gabriel Award-winning cable TV show Real Faith for the new evangelization television, and they're in production right now on their all their summer shows, and there's going to be a marathon of Real Faith on new evangelization television starting 8 p.m. Eastern time next Friday. Deacon Stephen Graydonis, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here. This is always feels like a homecoming for me because I got my start talking about movies in the Catholic faith right here on Catholic Answers Live 19 years ago, back in 2000.
Wow, think about that. And now you're big time. I mean, whenever the Register and all that, but you're also a member of the New York Film Critics Circle. That sounds like maybe there's meetings and in a place where people smoke pipes or that kind of thing, or I don't know, but it's that's lofty.
Yes, well, I'm not allowed to talk about those things.
Oh. But okay.
The awards dinner that we have every year is pretty fun. That is probably, these days, it's the coolest thing that I do as a film critic. It used to be back in the old days when Hollywood was throwing a lot of money at Christian film critics. Every once in a while, they would fly us out to Los Angeles or someplace else, and we would interview the big stars. But that doesn't happen anymore, so I lead a much more quiet life. And the most exciting thing I actually do is assist at the Mass and preach once a month or so.
Well, that's pretty good. I got to say, that's pretty good. You're
indeed
not.
Indeed it is.
But it doesn't have the, what is that? The glamour. What is the thing we say at Easter time? We reject the glamour of evil. I'm not saying that flying to Los Angeles is evil, but it has a kind of glamour to it. Okay, so I can remember I think it was my high school youth group. We went to the movies and we saw Franco Zeffirelli's Jesus of Nazareth, as I think pretty much every youth group of that era did. We have now lost Franco Zeffirelli.
Yeah, he died a couple of weeks ago. And, his movie Jesus of Nazareth means a lot to me. For me, especially the first 105, 107, 112 minutes of it is the best filming of the nativity story, of the story of the birth of Christ that has ever been committed to film, in my opinion. And in the Graydonis household, we watch that opening act every year at Christmas time. So I appreciate his work on that very much. I'm not as much a fan of his Francis of Assisi movie, Brother, Son, Sister, Moon, but he was a serious Catholic in his faith. He believed the teachings of the church. He was also a man whose lifestyle was wildly out of keeping with that. He was a homosexual and lived an openly, frankly, homosexual life. He has been accused in this era of Me Too of having sexually harassed and or assaulted a couple of actors who worked under him. And so, you know, this raises a lot of questions for us as Catholics and not just for Catholics, but a lot of people in our culture today are asking in this era of Me Too, as we see, you know, giants like Bill Cosby and Harvey Weinstein fall and other people, shadows fall over their reputations, and yet sometimes they've created art that we care about, and so there are a lot of questions to ask about how we approach that and when someone's lifestyle poisons their art and when we can still appreciate it in some cases in spite of who they were.
I have to say I feel myself somewhat in the category of art. If it's a beautiful work of art, it's a beautiful work of art, and it's okay to let yourself love it, even if the artist was bad. However, I must say, I get a very negative feeling when I look at Adolf Hitler's paintings. So I clear, clearly am not fully. Well, they're not beautiful for one thing. Have you ever seen Hitler's paintings? Are not good. They are not good.
So there you go.
But he painted a Madonna and Child, which I think might be the worst Madonna and Child ever painted. It is. But I guess my point though is okay. So certain figures, their art is going to be really irreparably tainted by their behavior. But, you know, a Mel Gibson, who I'm not sure all the things that Mel Gibson has done, but I know he had a drinking problem. Does that disqualify me from being able to appreciate Apocalypto as one of the greatest films ever made? It doesn't to me. Am I wrong in that?
It's a very good question, and it's a complicated question. In fact, it's not just one question, it's a number of different questions. I've written an article about this subject, taking Zeffirelli's life as a kind of point of departure. It's currently up at the National Catholic Register website, ncregister.com. It'll be up at Decent Film sometime over the weekend. And I try to take a look at some of those questions. So for me, I mean, I think you're right to struggle, because on the one hand, the relationship between an artist's life and their work, the two can inform one another. You know, I've seen some of the paintings of Fra Angelico, who is a canonized saint as well as a great artist. And there is a spirit of devotion in his work that flows, I believe, directly from his spirit. I don't think he could have been a debauched man and painted those paintings. And yet, I've also been to Rome and seen Caravaggio's The Conversion of St. Paul, and I've walked through the Vatican Museums, and I've walked through the Raphael Rooms. And The Conversion of St. Paul is a spectacular painting, and the Raphael Rooms contain some of the most astonishing sacred art that's ever been produced, especially the Disputation on the Holy Sacrament, I think, captures the theology of the Holy Eucharist in a way that I haven't seen any other work of art do. And yet, Caravaggio was a violent brawler. He had a vicious temper. He was exiled for murder. Raphael was a confirmed ladies' man. He carried on a torrid affair with his favorite model, whose face he used more than once for the Madonna. And it goes on from there. So it is possible, I think, sometimes for artistic inspiration almost to flow through an artist, like in a way almost analogous to sacramental grace flowing through an unworthy priest. But then at other times, we can see how an artist's sinful tendencies can infect their work.
Right.
And I don't think you need to condemn Mel Gibson's work whole and entire in order to say perhaps there are some aspects of his affinity for violence, perhaps, or the anti-Semitism that he was brought up in, that have left at least some mark on his work.
I see. Well, when you look at Caravaggio, you think that guy could murder somebody. It's so intense, the painting, but it doesn't take away from it's some of the greatest painting ever. So I don't know. Kevin Spacey is another one with all these problems. I suppose I don't want to rehearse everyone's problems, but brilliant work, like really brilliant work from Kevin Spacey.
And yet, in some cases, like I don't know about if this would apply to Hitler, even if he were a great painter. But when I think of somebody, even somebody whose work is innocuous, like, you know, The Cosby Show, I mean, you might find an episode here and there that was a problem. But for me, no matter how innocent or wholesome an episode of The Cosby Show might be, I could never go back and just enjoy it. Because to me, the show relies on your ability to feel the affection for Cliff Huxtable and in a way for Bill Cosby, because he's really playing on his image as America's dad. And when we found out that image was a lie, it really seems to me to kind of radically undermine the work that he did that relied on that persona.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. And it is actually kind of, there's something frightening about it too, if I may say. And we're talking movies with Deacon Stephen Gradonis, and you're welcome to get in on the conversation, 888-318-7884. Summer is the movie. Well, it used to be summer was the big movie time, but now I guess there's four or five of these periods, including the holiday season and what's called the holiday season and all that. But we'll talk about summer movies and all that. And if you have a question, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. But I was going to say, Deacon, there is something frightening when you, like you, if you take a person like Bill Cosby, there's a kind of wisdom in his work as a comedian. It's not just that he's funny. There's a kind of something really wonderful in what Cosby's able to do. And then you think, but that disconnect is so great between that and what you later find out about him that it almost frightens you about the human character.
You just used a really important word that I think not enough people pay attention to, which is disconnect. Yeah. That there's a disconnect. We talk about the virtue of integrity as if it meant only honesty and sincerity and trustworthiness. But what integrity really means, if you think about its non-moral meanings, like structural integrity, something that has structural integrity is something that doesn't fall apart. All of the parts are connected into an integral whole. And this is what happens with a person's personality. You can really become different people under different circumstances. Yeah. And we all kind of socially respond differently to different people under different circumstances. But if you have integrity, then there's a harmony among your different social selves, who you are at work, who you are at home, who you are at church. They might be different, but they're in harmony with one another. What happens when you lack that virtue of integrity is you give yourself permission to become someone who is a fundamentally different person from that wise and wholesome person that you seem to be in other circumstances. And as you say, it is very frightening.
Man, that is such a well-made point. And I'll tell you what, if nothing else good happens this hour, you made it worth it. But I
45 minutes to go.
Yeah. No, if you keep piling it on like this could be a prize winner this show. But I got to go to the break. But as you're speaking, I'm thinking this is a man who is an ordained minister, a deacon of the Catholic Church, too. There's something about the sacraments that make that integrity possible, that actually kind of if you surrender to the sacraments.
Yes, but at the same time, you know, this is the kind of, you know, both and where if you are faithful to it, it can help you to have that integrity. But we've seen so clearly in people like McCarrick that you can also, you know, that the grace of the sacrament can become the very thing that damns you, because McCarrick had that very same ability to become different people under different circumstances. He lacked that integrity. And unfortunately, that's, you know, there's a lot of that in the Catholic Church today.
Stephen Gradonis, not afraid to name names, but we're going to talk about summer movies when we come back. We'll take a quick break and more with Deacon Stephen Gradonis, the film critic of the National Catholic Register, right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Divine Intimacy Radio.
The greatest joy in my life is helping others to come to know Christ more fully. And there's no better light on this path, the path to deep union with God, than the wisdom of the saints. Talking about this daily on EWTN Radio is one of the great joys of my life.
Divine Intimacy Radio, Sunday, 6:30 a.m., 1:30 p.m., and 11 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
I'm going to venture out on a limb and say the greatest patron of the arts in the history of the world is the Catholic Church. And we Catholics, we don't talk about art enough. This should be something that's close to every Catholic's heart and something that we are conversant in, especially in a world that has so devalued and degraded the idea of art in many ways. That's why we're always delighted to have Deacon Stephen Graydonis with us, a deacon of the Catholic Church and also a man who understands art and spends his life exposing himself to our works of art and sharing them with us. Thanks again for being with us, Deacon Graydonis. Is it fair enough to say what I said about the Catholic Church and the Catholic faith? Should we be conversant in the arts?
The Church itself tells us that we should be conversant in the arts, and not just in the arts of our own culture, but those of different cultures and subcultures around the world. You know, this is... It is no exaggeration to say that the Catholic Church has taken an image in motion pictures before the cinema existed. So before cinema was even a thing, that the different technologies in the late 19th century that were beginning to strain toward the cinema, the Church was interested in. There were demonstrations in Catholic universities. One of the earliest films that was ever shot was of Pope Leo XIII in the Vatican in the 1890s. Clips of him in the Vatican gardens and on his papal throne giving a blessing to the camera were brought to the United States. They were shown to Catholics in New York and Boston and Chicago. And Pope Pius XI in Vigilante Cura, 1936, the first... papal document devoted entirely to the motion picture said there does not exist today a means of influencing the masses more potent than the cinema. So the cinema kind of sums up in itself all of the different aspects of the arts that the Church has always taken an interest in. You know, we were talking before the break about the Raphael rooms in the Vatican museums in the Apostolic Palace and the Sistine Chapel and the art that decorates many of our churches. The Church has always looked to the arts as a means of communication, as a means of communicating not only to the mind, but to the imagination. And what cinema does is it brings the power of pictures in motion.
Yeah.
And combining it not only the visual arts, but all of the other arts. It's got the plastic arts, painting, sculpture, architecture, but it's also got the temporal arts, music, dance, poetry. You can subdivide the temporal arts into the performing arts and the literary arts. And so you have drama and acting and narrative prose. Cinema embraces all of these. Right. For this reason, it's been called the synthesis of all of the arts.
Wow. And Catholics, too, have been great contributors there. I mean, you think of, someone like, well, Mel Gibson in the current state to, now you're going to have to help me because I always have trouble with names, but the guy who made A Wonderful Life, he was a Catholic, wasn't he?
Yes. Frank Capra.
Frank Capra.
Many of the early Hollywood directors were Catholics. Capra is certainly an example.
I was thinking too.
Alfred Hitchcock.
That's the one. Alfred Hitchcock. Yeah.
Martin Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola.
Right.
Leo McCarey. So many of these filmmakers come from Catholic backgrounds, and I think that's not an accident. And there are a number of different reasons why that's the case, but certainly I think the cultural heritage of the Church and the Church's heritage of caring about visual arts informed the imaginations of these filmmakers. When you grow up in Gothic cathedrals and surrounded by magnificent art. We were talking before the break about Franco Zeffirelli.
Yeah.
So Franco Zeffirelli grew up in Florence. He grew up surrounded by the Renaissance, and that informed his approach to the arts. He was a designer, a producer, and a director of opera and theater, and he brought a real kind of florid drama to his works that was meant to reach out to the masses. You know, when we think of opera, we think of, you know, something that's kind of snooty and highfalutin and not accessible. But Zeffirelli believed that enduring art is art that's meant to reach everyone. He said, you know, can you imagine if some critics were to, you know, say of the Sistine Chapel, oh, it's not in fashion anymore? Well, okay, but you may not like it, but let's make sure that we still have it for future generations.
Yeah, without question. We always hear this multiculturalism, but one form of multiculturalism is to be able to sympathize with the people of the past. Their culture wasn't the same. It was it's not there anymore. But it's not just people from different places in the world, but on the timeline as well.
Absolutely. And that's one of the great things about the cinema is that you can go back and immerse yourself to some extent or other, in the world of the 1940s or the 1920s. You can see what a Jesus movie looked like in the 1920s as filmed by Cecil B. DeMille in The King of Kings. And it's not like a film that we have today. And yet it has a power, and it communicates in its own way. You can even go back further to early Passion plays that are available on DVD and get a sense of the religious imagination of the past. And this is something that we care about as Catholics. It's why when you crack open the Catechism of the Catholic Church, or even more, the Compendium of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, that there are these color plates with images in them, because we cannot reduce the heritage of our faith to the spoken or the printed word. Images are a fundamental part of sacred tradition. They're a fundamental part of the way that we have handed on our faith. And for me, as a Catholic parent, as well as a deacon and a film critic, it's part of the way that I have tried to catechize and to develop the religious and the moral imaginations of my own children through the movies that we watch as a family.
We are going to talk about some of this summer's movies. There's folks on the line who'd like to talk with you, however, Deacon Greidanis. Would that be all right if we take some calls?
Sure, absolutely.
All right. Will in Gulfport, Mississippi, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. You're up first today, Will. Thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Your question for Deacon Greidanis.
Hey guys, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to share with you, there's an O.J. Simpson documentary out that was on ESPN the other day. I think it's called Made in America. It's got a very benign title. And I don't know if it's critically acclaimed and everything, but it had some really disturbing images, never before seen crime scene photos showing the actual desecrated bodies of the victims. And I was wondering, is that disrespectful to that victim and the family to show those images, and should movies or documentaries show those kinds of images?
That's a really good question, and it's a question for which it's, as with so many questions in the moral sphere, it's very, in regard to the arts, it's very hard to give a clear or a black or white answer. One of the kind of guiding lights in my thought in regard to this are the wise words of a priest of the Oblates of the Virgin Mary that a reader once quoted to me, and I actually mentioned this in my article on Franco Zeffirelli. The Catholic Church teaches authoritatively, has always taught authoritatively, and will always teach authoritatively that the visual arts are a gray area. And that's not 100% accurate, but it gets at something that's very important. Let me just say that O.J. Made in America is an absolutely riveting documentary, 7.5 hours. It was produced for ESPN. It illuminates and critiques the various social spheres and cultural spheres in which O.J. Simpson kind of shaped his different public and private personas. We were talking before the break about the virtue of integrity and the way in which people take on different selves and fashion different selves, and are they in harmony? And I think very clearly O.J. is a person who's different. The different parts of his life were not in harmony, and the way in which he tried to escape or to conquer the different aspects of his world, I thought that O.J. Made in America was fantastic, and I do highly recommend it, with that very important caveat that it is a disturbing story and there are disturbing images in it. And, there are all kinds of questions that we might ask ourselves at this point. Were the families of the victims consulted? I know that they participated in the making of the movie. They are interviewed in the movie. So I don't know. I can't say specifically that they gave their blessing to it or that they approved the use of the images. But I can understand the concern. I wouldn't want to leap to any conclusions. And overall, even if there were a problem here, even if this were something where we had to say, you know, this is something that shouldn't have been done, that doesn't take away entirely from the virtue of the documentary. I hope that helps.
Will, thank you very, very much. Appreciate the call. I had similar feelings about the documentary Senna. I don't know if you saw that about the race car driver.
I did.
Ayrton,
yes.
Senna. There's some really horrific stuff in there, but you kind of got to see that to know what we're talking about with Formula One racing.
Absolutely.
Also, a very fine documentary, I thought. Before I go to some movies that are coming out, you and I have had a disagreement in the past, slight disagreement about Tom Cruise. Did you see Fallout, Mission Impossible Fallout, and have you finally come to understand how good Tom Cruise is?
What are you talking about? You must be thinking of somebody else. I think Tom Cruise is great. Let's talk about him after the break.
Okay, we'll do that after the break and talk about some of the movies, including Spider-Man and Toy Story 4 and things coming out this summer. More of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew that she wanted those things, that in them somehow she would find God. Over the years as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
In his new audio presentation, The Very First Fathers, apologist Jimmy Akin takes you on a tour of the earliest Christian writings outside the New Testament, from the most famous figures and most notable works to those lesser known but no less important. This pivotal time in the development of the early church is revealed in fascinating detail. Jimmy shows how, even in the first century after the resurrection, it was necessary to defend and explain truths that are still under attack today, such as the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist and the perpetual virginity of Mary. The Very First Fathers is a compelling look at the dawn of the Christian age and edifying listening for anyone who wants to understand and defend the full truth of Catholicism. Order your copy of The Very First Fathers today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Looking for an on-fire Catholic speaker for your event? Catholic Answers speakers will inform and inspire your audience to grow in their Catholic faith. For more information on booking a Catholic Answers speaker, visit CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com today.
Monday on More to Life, R-E-S-P-E-C-T.
What you want, baby, we got it. We're going to help you get a little respect.
That's Monday on More to Life. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Talking about the pictures with Deacon Stephen Graydonis, the film critic for the National Catholic Register and a member of the New York Film Critics Circle. Okay, so I was teasing you a little bit about Tom Cruise. I thought that we had a disagreement about him, but I may well have recollected that wrongly. But I'm a fan of Tom Cruise. I think he does a good job.
I think he's wonderful to watch in the right role, and the right role is. For me, it's a role that gives him the ability to be really intense because he has this laser-like intensity like nobody else. I think the first time I really became aware of it was in the famous CIA break-in sequence in Brian De Palma's Mission Impossible back in 1996.
Yeah.
And which is not a great movie, but he's so great in that scene. And it's a great scene. De Palma really did scenes rather than whole movies. And he kind of – it took him three or four movies to kind of figure out who Ethan Hunt was. But I think the last three Mission Impossible movies, Ghost Protocol, Rogue Nation, and now Fallout, I think that they're the most vital ongoing Hollywood blockbuster franchise that there is. Full disclosure, I haven't seen the John Wicks yet. I have to catch up on that.
Do you?
But yeah, well, I've heard really good things about it. But what I love about Ethan Hunt, besides the fact that the action and the choreography in these is really so wonderful, and his commitment to doing the stunts himself, you know, this is a Catholic show, and you're wondering where am I going with this as a Catholic, but there's an integrity and a truthfulness to images that convey something about the real world without being purely faked, right?
Yeah.
So when you see a character seem to do some amazing stunt, but it's chopped up into 37 different cuts and you only see each for like a split second and it's all in close-ups, did you really see anything at all? There was a famous Catholic film theorist, André Bazin, who really made film studies the academic discipline that it is today. He was a Catholic, and for him, cinema had the power to preserve something of the truth of creation itself. And, you know, there's a reason why it's exciting when you watch Raiders of the Lost Ark and you get the shot under the Nazi truck and you can see that it's really Harrison Ford hanging on for dear life to that bullwhip as he's being dragged to the road. Yes, it's a stunt. Yes, they're driving really slowly. Yes, he's wearing pads under his clothing. But there's still – it wasn't just, you know, stitched together with computers.
Yes.
Not that they had computers back then. But you see my point. You know,
I do.
Tom Cruise is committed to doing these stunts himself, and he kind of – there's a kind of a partnership there that he's offering something to you, the viewer. This is his gift to you, and it's really kind of – beautiful in a way.
You get it. You get it. See, I know you get it. Speaking of franchises, the biggest franchise in the history of the world just closed a chapter with the Avengers Endgame.
Yes.
But I guess we're opening up again a new chapter with the Spider-Man Far From Home.
Yes, that's right. So Spider-Man was one of the characters who disappeared in Infinity War. 5 years later, he was brought back in Endgame. So this is Tom Holland's Spider-Man kind of catching up with his life. And the first Spider-Man Holland movie was called Homecoming. It was a play on words because there was a homecoming dance, but it was also the character's homecoming to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. There's a long story about film rights there that I won't get into. This one is called Far From Home. So he goes on a class trip with his family, or not with his family, with his classmates, a school trip to Europe, and he visits different European cities. And while he's there, of course, the Earth is attacked. And, you know, I have to say, I think that the whole Infinity War Endgame saga was done really remarkably well when you consider the scale of it and just how ambitious that storytelling was. What I enjoyed about Homecoming was it was just a superhero movie. It was a self-contained story. It wasn't tying up loose threads from 100 other things, although you can't get out entirely from under the shadow of the Infinity War. And it isn't necessarily building toward anything either. It's about a boy who likes a girl, Zendaya's MJ, and who spends the whole movie wanting to tell her how he feels about her. And, you know, the teenage behavior is fairly true to life and the emotions. And, yeah, I enjoyed it.
All right. I'm glad to hear. Well, we're underway again then with a new, I don't know if it'll be a 20 story arc like the last one was. I believe I've said this to you before, but I think if the Avengers had ended with Infinity War, just ended there, it would have been the greatest ending ever in the history. That was the proper place to end it. But they had to bring everybody back. So we have another Spider-Man. What about Toy Story? Toy Story's got another movie, Toy Story 4. This is a franchise that's revolutionary, truly revolutionary, revolutionized movies.
Yes, absolutely. The first Toy Story, which came out in 1995, changed the world, and it was perfect and it was brilliant. There's so many interesting moral and philosophical and artistic themes to talk about in the Toy Story movies. But the important thing to understand here is that a little bit like with Spider-Man Far From Home, the Toy Story saga, which could have been completed with the first film, it could have been complete with the second one, they went on to a third film and they really brought the story of Woody and Andy to a close. And with that third film, we see that it was really always about Woody and Andy. It wasn't Woody and Buzz, it was Woody and Andy. And now with Toy Story 4, it's a new chapter, it's a new story, it's not continuing the same story anymore. And there are some fascinating philosophical questions that they get into with regard to the consciousness of toys and what is it that makes a toy alive. And when Bonnie, the little girl who inherits Woody and all the rest, takes a plastic fork and wraps pipe cleaner arms around it and sticks googly eyes onto it, and suddenly it wakes up and it's a living spork, plastic spork, and it wants to throw itself in the garbage because it doesn't understand that it's no longer a piece of junk. Now it's a toy. And you know, this raises for me, I start thinking about Thomas Aquinas and Catholic natural law theory and teleology, because the whole Toy Story world is based on teleology, which is the foundation of Catholic natural law theory, the idea that, that things have a purpose. And so toys naturally find fulfillment in what they're made for, which is to be played with by children. But here's a spork that wants to throw itself away. It hasn't yet glommed to the idea that love has given a deeper purpose. Here we get into kind of John Paul II Christian personalism, the idea that we find our true identity in love.
And that is fascinating.
I can say so much more.
Because teleology is basically what's missing from our society. We don't anymore think that things can be known by their purpose. We think that they're known by what made them. If evolution made me, then that's how I know myself. That's what I am. I'm just a product of evolution, not I have a purpose that leads on to glory.
That's right. And so there is this kind of tension, even in Toy Story 4, between, you know, the idea that the toy has a destiny, that there is nothing nobler than loving a child and being loved by a child. And then the idea embodied in another character that maybe it's okay for toys to kind of outlive their lifetime as playthings and then kind of go off on their own and have adventures. And here we get into a different metaphor in the Toy Story world, which is the idea of toys as surrogate parents. In the second Toy Story movie particularly, Woody is a surrogate parent figure who fears the empty nest. He fears being left on a shelf by Andy when he grows up and goes off to college, and it gives him a profound crisis about his relationship with Andy. And so when you look at it from that way, the idea of toys kind of having a life after their kids grow up isn't as disturbing as it might seem otherwise.
888-318-7884 is the number. We're talking movies, summer movies, and all others this hour with Deacon Stephen Gradonis, the film critic for the National Catholic Register. 888-318-7884. I'm going to give you a minute to dial that phone because I got to remind people that a lot of stuff is coming to an end here as this month ends here at Catholic Answers. The Catholic Answers magazine sale ends when the month ends, and that's the one where you can get $10 off a one-year subscription and $20 off a two-year subscription to the greatest Catholic magazine on earth. You just go to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com and you can get it, but you got to get it before the end of the weekend. Then it won't be available anymore after that. But the other thing that's going away is the early bird pricing for the conference. We've got the Catholic Answers annual conference, September 26th through 29th. The early church was the Catholic Church is the theme of the conference. Everybody around here is thrilled because it really is looking like this is going to be the best conference we've ever done. And the early bird pricing goes away on Tuesday of next week. So that's just a little bit of time left. To get your tickets to go to the conference, and I got to say, they're not very expensive. You'll be surprised. It's a pretty good deal. Get that early bird pricing over at CatholicAnswersConference.com. CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I said to the sisters one day, what do you think you're going to look like in heaven? Oh, some of them had absolutely magnificent ideas. I didn't think of one of them. And so I got desperate because then my turn came. I didn't know what to say. And so in desperation, I said, what do you think I'll wear in heaven? And they all said with one voice, armor!
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Okay, we covered Spider-Man, Far From Home, Toy Story 4 with Deacon Stephen Graydonis. More to cover. Did we get to everything you wanted to get to on those two, Deacon?
You know, I like to talk about the fun things about the movies and what it is that I like about them, but we should also note that many of these movies that have positive qualities also have areas of concern. And in regard to Toy Story 4, one of my main concerns has to do with an area where Pixar has historically done really well. When you watch Pixar movies, they don't do the usual thing of family films, especially Disney films, of celebrating the hero against adversity that, you know, the parents are against him, the society's against him, but he does or she does their own thing, and in the end, they're vindicated. The protagonists in Toy Story movies are morally complicated. They make mistakes. They mess up, and then they have to face the music. They have to realize, oh my gosh, I knocked Buzz Lightyear out of a window because I was jealous, and now I've lost Andy's favorite toy. You know, yeah. I've run away from home, and I'm on a bus going back to my hometown. I have to get back to my parents. This kind of thing.
Well, you've ruined the movies for me now, by the way. I haven't seen any of them, so now they're ruined.
In Toy Story 4, though, there's a character who does one of the worst things that anyone has ever done in any Pixar movie, and certainly in any Toy Story movie. I'm not going to give any spoilers, but the character is basically a villain, worse than Lotso Huggin' Bear from Toy Story 3. And then the movie takes this character on a kind of quasi-redemptive arc without any real moral reckoning with the truly heinous things that have been done. And I don't mind a movie that redeems the villain. I like it when a movie redeems the villain, but I feel like there needed to be more of an honest facing up to what happened, and that didn't happen. And that to me is a real miss for Toy Story 4. For Spider-Man, you know, there are different things that didn't work. The one thing that really sticks out to me, because it kind of rhymes with a moment that I didn't like in Spider-Man Homecoming, is the porn joke. There's a pornography joke in both of these Spider-Man movies, and the fact that it recurs makes me think there's somebody on the creative team that wants to make this a recurring thing in the Spider-Man movies. And Spider-Man is probably the single Marvel character that little kids are most interested in. I know my little boy really looks up to Spider-Man, and I love Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which is streaming on Netflix. If you have Netflix, second best movie of last year, according to me, maybe the best. Wonderful family film, wonderful cartoon, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Family friendly compared to Spider-Man Far From Home, which is a movie that now, you know, I'm not going to take my kids to. And that porn joke is part of the reason why.
All right. I'm glad we were able to visit those. One of the things that I like when you're on, too, is that you kind of have your hand on the pulse of what's going on in the world of documentaries. And a lot is going on. Any good documentaries you want to point us to, or maybe bad ones you want to point us away from?
Well, you know, I always wish that I knew more about documentaries than I do. And there's so much going on in that world. But I happened to be at Sundance Film Festival in January, and I saw a film which is coming to theaters in August. And you, Catholic listener, you want to see One Child Nation. This is it's a cultural inquiry. It's a political expose. It's a personal journey about China's infamous one child policy from a pair of filmmakers, Nanfu Wang and Xiaoling Zhang, who grew up in China under the one child policy. And it pieces together the costs and the methods of the policy, the human rights abuses. Wang goes back to China. She interviews family members, local officials, people who are affected by this. We learn about the propaganda campaign that was just surrounded and immersed people in imbuing this total loyalty to the infallible party and its wise policy. And, you know, you see some people who are really guilty about this. We hear from a midwife who is really racked by guilt over the forced abortions that she participated in. And now she spends her life trying to help infertile couples conceive as a result of this. We also see, you know, a village official who feels sorry for himself and talks about how hard it was in those days. It's only 85 minutes long. You know, a movie like this could always do more. But One Child Nation, you know, you want to talk about a movie that has implicit pro-life resonances. This is definitely going to be on my top 10 films this coming year.
I am so glad to hear that you recommended that. I didn't know about this film, but this is one of the great horrors of the 20th century and 21st century that Western media utterly missed. I mean, people barely know about it. I'm so glad that you found that film and that you were able to recommend it for us. One Child Nation, I will definitely find that. What about, anything else? Anything else grabbing you that you want to let us know about?
You know, there are a few things that I'm looking forward to on the horizon, but it's always changing as we get close to them, and I prefer to talk about movies as they come out.
All right, Dark Phoenix is it the greatest movie ever? I haven't seen it yet.
Just, you know, superhero culture really dominates pop culture these days. And I have to say that X-Men, the original X-Men back in 2000, which really opened the door to the world that we live in today, it also gave us the character who remains for me after, you know, 11 years of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the single most genuinely inspiring superhero on the cinema of comic books today, which is Patrick Stewart's Professor Xavier.
Oh yeah, ultimate decent hero.
Well, but see, okay, so Captain America is decent.
Okay.
But the question is he anything other than decent? What does the guy really stand for? Does he stand for freedom, truth, justice in the American way? No, because you can't sell tickets in China if you're going to have a genuinely patriotic hero. But Professor X has an ideal. He has a true vision for a better world, a world in which humans and mutants can coexist in harmony. He's like the Martin Luther King figure of his world. And then, of course, you have Magneto, Ian McKellen's Magneto, as the sort of Malcolm X figure, the guy who wants what's good for my people by any means necessary. A little more kind of Nation of Islam, fire and brimstone. And so I find that guy inspiring because he speaks to me about the world that I live in a powerful way. And, you know, because he's played by Patrick Stewart, who's awesome. So Dark Phoenix is the close of this kind of second chapter of the X-Men world, in which Professor X is mostly played throughout the series by James McAvoy, who is brilliant and wonderful, but he's playing a much shallower and obviously younger version of the character, but a character who doesn't ever seem to be growing up to be Patrick Stewart. And instead of this kind of real moral ideal, there's a constant cross-examining of him. Does he really want a better world for mutants and humans living together, or does he just want survival for his people? Or is he just in it for the glory, you know, to be acclaimed on the world stage? All of these accusations are thrown at him, and at least some of them are true. This is the second Hollywood take on a very famous storyline from the comics, the Dark Phoenix saga, first told in the third X-Men movie, the Last Stand, universally considered one of the worst movies. This movie is now at least that bad, unfortunately. So it's a sad ending to a franchise that began really strongly, and that as recently as Days of Future Past, which brought back Patrick Stewart in at least part of its split storyline storytelling, really tapped the power of this franchise.
Well, does the world end in Dark Phoenix? Because every other movie, the world is ending. And this seems to have real spiritual or religious importance in a way. The fact that the world is constantly in our movies. I mean, we've got Godzilla out now. Just one after another, you know.
And not just on the big screen, but on the small screen too. You know, you've got the Walking Dead and Battlestar Galactica.
Is this a wish? Are we wishing for all of this to end because our lives have become uncomfortable in late modernity?
It's a good question. I wrote an article on what I call the secular apocalypse, and I'm not the first Christian thinker to take on this story. There's also There's also a book called How to Survive the Apocalypse by Alyssa Wilkinson, a Christian film critic, and Robert Joustra, which I recommend. And they look at this trend that I believe they are both Protestants, but they look at the trend through the philosophy of the Catholic philosopher Charles Taylor, who talks about how he interprets what it means to be secular in our times. And it's not just the decline of religion, it's the decline of a kind of social context in which religious categories have any kind of common frame of reference, in which society kind of has a picture for you for what is meaning and what is truth. And we all have to kind of create and invent our own meaning. And, you know, between that, between the kind of subjectivity and relativity of our age, and then also what Pope Benedict XVI has pointed to in the disappointment of modernity and the passing into post-modernity and then even post-everything culture or post-culture that we live in. You know, there was a time when the modernists told us, when Gene Roddenberry told us that the future was going to be shining and great and science. Yeah. Progress, we're going to make everything wonderful. We weren't going to be racist anymore. You know, that we were going to cleanse the earth. We were going to just ascend and we weren't going to have any more sickness. And what's happening in reality? People are more concerned than ever about, you know, climate change and microplastics in the ocean. And now sociologists tell us that, you know, racism is embedded in social institutions in a much more profound way than, you know, we thought in the 1960s, you know, civil rights is going to solve all this. And now it doesn't look like, you know, these kinds of issues are going away. So I think all of these things together kind of add up to an anxiety because we're not satisfied with where we are. We know that we're made for something more than this. And yet we no longer have a picture of what that something is. We don't know what the kingdom looks like anymore. Gene Roddenberry tried to sell us on an alternate kingdom of heaven, the Federation, and we don't believe in that anymore either. And that's why we're in the kind of despairing place that we're in.
So that's what you see is despair, that these secular apocalypses, when you think of something like The Walking Dead, it's just, it really does look like despair.
It's not that there's no hope.
Right.
There are signs of hope in many of these stories, not in all of them. Some of them end with complete annihilation, with total destruction. Joss Whedon's, he co-wrote Cabin in the Woods, which starts off as a kind of horror spoof, but then morphs into a truly despairing end of the world story in which humanity is just not worth saving. And the movie The Dead Don't Die, which is in theaters right now from Jim Jarmusch, who directed Patterson, my favorite film from a couple of years ago, Patterson. This is a zombie movie, a zombie apocalypse, and Adam Driver keeps saying throughout the movie, this isn't going to end well, and it doesn't.
Yeah, well, it's something to think of because, you know, I wonder too how much there's something about the apocalypse, there's something about the end of the world that makes you feel alive, and it makes you think that the reason we have to keep having these apocalyptic fantasies in our movies is we actually feel dead.
Yes, absolutely. It is a way of feeling alive, a way of stimulating yourself to feel something. And I think it's worth paying attention to these stories, even when, you know, some of them are profound and well done. Others of them are boring or bad or even offensive. But all of them in some way hold up a mirror to the soul of the culture that created it, which is also a culture, whether we like it or not, whether we want it or not, we are all products of that culture. We exist in that culture. And so understanding it is a way sometimes of recognizing what's good about it, but also of consciously rejecting what's bad, and, you know, of being able to have a conversation with our non-Christian or our non-Catholic neighbors about where we are as a culture, you know, understanding what are the shared stories and images that enable us to communicate, that kind of inform our thinking.
And then heading out to the movies is actually a kind of social act now, where people are rejecting social acts. It's not sitting in your house just streaming videos to yourself. It at least has some quality of a shared experience. And I think that makes us feel alive as well.
It can, especially when it's a movie that, you know, isn't just the latest blockbuster that people stumble to because advertising told them to. When you go to see a smaller movie, even a movie like The Dead Don't Die, if you go to the theaters and see Jim Jarmusch's The Dead Don't Die, you'll be one of like four or five people in the theater. But everyone there chose to be there, probably because in many cases they like some of Jarmusch's other films, and you can sometimes have interesting conversations after experiences like that.
Deacon Stephen Graydonis, may we have your blessing before we go.
The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you. The Lord be gracious unto you now and forever and give you his peace. In the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit.
Amen. Thank you so much, Deacon. I really love these conversations. Wait a second. Teleology and Charles Taylor came up in a... I thought I was the only one who knew Charles Taylor. I'm so glad. He's one of my favorites. I'm so glad you mentioned him. You can find Deacon Stephen Graydonis over at the National Catholic Register. You can also next Friday night on New Evangelization Television catch the marathon of Stephen Graydonis' television program, Real... Oh, wait. What's the second word? Real...
Faith.
Real Faith.
Real Faith.
I lost it there for a second. Thanks again, Deacon. Coming up, game show. You don't want to miss it.